And we still don't know how far and wide that oil spill in the Gulf will spread. The threat is forcing many to make contingency plans. NPR's Greg Allen reports about the worries at a big tourist destination in Miami, the Seaquarium.
For 55 years now, the Seaquarium has been an institution in Miami. Several times a day, visitors can watch dolphin, killer whale, and sea lion shows. General Manager Andrew Hertz says the Seaquarium, perched on Virginia Key in the middle of Biscayne Bay, enjoys advantages other aquariums and marine parks like SeaWorld don't have.
We pull our water for our animals straight out of the bay, and we filter it and we give them clean water. But the quality of our water is only as good as the quality of the bay.
And now the quality of seawater in the southeastern U.S. has become a concern. Miami's Seaquarium is hundreds of miles and on the other side of the Florida peninsula from the oil spill. Concerns that the Gulf's loop current could bring the oil around the peninsula into the Atlantic have diminished a bit lately. The current has developed into a circular eddy that so far is keeping the oil inside the Gulf. But Seaquarium officials say a change in current, wind patterns, or the arrival of a hurricane could instantly change that, polluting the water the marine park's 1,000 birds, mammals, and fish depend on.
I take in 10,000 gallons a minute, 24 hours a day.
Einar Gustafsson is Seaquarium's Park Services Director and the man who's now scrambling to develop a plan to safeguard the cleanliness of its seawater.
We're looking at wells to augment our water supply. We're looking at oil-water separators. There's a lot of different options in there.
And none of them are cheap. A few years ago, Seaquarium invested $3 million on a new filtration system. Now it looks like it will need millions more to ensure its water remains free of petrochemicals. General Manager Andrew Hertz says the park's most vulnerable animals are its fish, like the rays swimming in one of its outside tanks.
We've got spotted eagle ray right here coming by, and then we've got some southern stingrays in here. And they look like fairly hardy animals, but these guys are reliant on the cleanliness of this water for their oxygen.
And unless the water remains perfectly oil-free, they'll suffer. This aquarium is now working on a multi-million dollar funding proposal that it plans to take to the state and eventually to BP. It's those kind of unforeseen and far-flung expenses that will continue to bubble up in the months ahead, and which seem likely to make the Deepwater Horizon the nation's most expensive oil spill yet. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
While oil continues to cloud the waters of the Gulf Coast, across the country in California, scientists are studying a different problem. The San Francisco Bay is becoming clearer. And as Lauren Summer reports, this poses a threat to the area's fragile wetlands.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Alcatraz. Thank you
for— Hundreds of tourists are pouring off the ferry on Alcatraz Island today. But two of the passengers aren't here for the historic prison. What they're looking for is underneath the dock. David Scholhammer is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He holds up a bottle of cloudy bay water that he just collected.
What we're measuring here is suspended sediments. You can think of it as the little microscopic rocks that are floating in the water.
To most of us, that would just be mud. But for Scholhammer, the bottle holds important clues about the bay's history. About 10 years ago, he noticed something strange in these samples. The bay's water was becoming clearer after more than a century of murkiness.
Back in the 1800s, late 1800s, during the gold rush, the gold miners used essentially fire hoses and water cannons to literally wash down mountainsides to extract the gold from the sediment.
The mining sent massive pulses of earth from the Sierra foothills into the watershed.
About 250 million cubic meters of sediment deposited in the bay.
That's enough mud, rock, and sand to fill 36 million dump trucks.
It really threw everything out of whack because there was so much extra sediment.
Scholhammer says now that the extra sediment has finally worked its way out the Golden Gate, the bay's water is about 30% clearer than it was 10 years ago. That could help some fish and other species. But for the bay's shoreline, clearer doesn't always mean better.
So we're at China Camp State Park, right on the edge of San Pablo Bay, and we're on the upper part of a salt marsh.
On the water's edge in San Rafael, Professor John Calloway of the University of San Francisco and his researcher Evan Borgnes are taking a core sample of this soggy wetland by pulling up a thick aluminum tube that they've sunk into the mud.
So we just slowly push. It's stuck.
This thick mud was once sediment out in the bay. Callaway says it's key for a wetland's survival. With every high tide, these marshes are built up by the sediment they trap from the water. And less sediment in the bay could spell trouble. That's because these wetlands are facing a new pressure, rising sea levels, which scientists are predicting will inundate these tidal marshes over the next century.
The big question is, how much will it go up in the future? If it goes up to 8 to 10 millimeters per year, then I think many wetlands are really unlikely to survive.
Wetlands are home to all sorts of plants and animals, from egrets to harbor seals and fish. But they also do another job, protect shoreline development from storm surges. Steve Goldbeck is with the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. He says critical infrastructure, like Oakland and San Francisco airports, are right in the path of rising waters.
What wetlands do is they can absorb those peak storm surges, those waves that are rolling in. When they hit the wetland, it knocks down the wave peaks.
With 80% of the bay's historic wetlands already destroyed, Goldbeck says restoration projects will be a vital tool to combat sea level rise. Right now, millions of cubic yards of sediment are dredged in the bay to keep shipping channels clear. Goldbeck's agency is looking at how to recycle that material now that sediment is becoming a valuable resource. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Sommer.
You're listening to NPR News.
Oily beaches and lost livelihoods are obvious effects of the Gulf oil spill, but there's also a less visible impact threatening communities there. Depression is taking root in small fishing towns. Last month, an Alabama boat captain who friends say was despondent about the spill took his own life. The Surgeon General was in Alabama yesterday, and she's in Florida today talking about this very issue. NPR's Julie Rose reports on the mental health toll of the Gulf spill.
On June 9th, day 51 of the Gulf oil spill, Garrett Moniz checked himself into the hospital. He was having a nervous breakdown.
I mean, I feel like everything's been taken from me, you know, not just my livelihood, you know, my life.
Moniz got his first boat when he was 8. He's been a commercial fisherman for nearly all of his 29 years in the small Louisiana bayou town of Hopedale. His buzzed haircut and chiseled features make him look pretty tough. But the oil spill has left Moniz completely deflated. You can hear it in his voice as he talks about the 6 days he spent in the hospital.
Yeah, I'm watching it on the news and I'm seeing it still, and it's still there, but I just put my mind in there and forgot it. Just let everything out here just be whatever it is.
He was really, like, suicidal.
This is Moniz's fiance, Carmen Mackles.
His dad was a fisherman. All his friends are fishermen. His uncles, you know, that's all he's ever been. He's never had any other job.
Now the stress of being out of work, of wondering if things will ever return to normal, of waiting for a check from BP to help pay the bills, is wearing on Moniz and thousands like him up and down the coast. Some, like Moniz, turn to church. He says the singing and praying make him feel hopeful. Others drink. More than 3,000 have sought out crisis counselors at centers set up by Catholic Charities Archdiocese of New Orleans. Gulf states have asked BP for millions of dollars to pay for mental health services. So far, none of those requests have been granted, though BP is offering crisis counseling to locals working on the cleanup effort. But social workers say commercial fishermen are an independent lot, reluctant to ask for this kind of help. If they're turning to anyone, it's friends and family, like Diane Phillips.
A lot of people call me Mama D. Come on, baby. Let me hug his neck, too.
Phillips is not a professional counselor. She fishes and guides boat tours. But she's a good listener and has lived in Hopedale a long time. Lately, she says the extra folding chair on the porch in front of her weathered trailer is almost always occupied.
Most of the commercial fishermen have fractured families at this point. Not that they're divorced, but a lot of the young mothers have made the decision to stay in Mississippi or in North Louisiana so they don't have to worry about everything that we've dealt with since Katrina.
And just as some of those wives were looking to come back, just when things seemed to be turning around, the spill happened. University of South Alabama sociologist Steve P. Koo documented significantly higher rates of anxiety and depression in Alaska fishing towns after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. He expects the same in the Gulf because of what he calls a corrosive social cycle.
See, there's an all clear that's signaled after a natural disaster, and you know when it has ended.
That gives communities closure, and people tend to pull together in recovery. But with a man-made disaster like an oil spill, Piku says the effects unfold over time, and it's more common to see communities tear apart. People get caught up blaming the company and fighting for a piece of the compensation pie. In Alaska, Piku says the legal battle with Exxon became like a second disaster for the people.
And by 2000, what we found was that the primary source of stress relating to the spill was being a litigant and not being a commercial fisherman.
It's always going to bring out the best in some, the worst in others.
Petrina Balzer grew up in the fishing towns of St. Bernard Parish. Now she runs a Catholic Charities crisis center there.
I have actually seen families, longtime friends who are not speaking anymore because of the anger issues, the blames, you getting on, I'm not, and it's a really, really sad thing to see.
But Balzer also says the Gulf's fishing communities are full of incredibly resilient people. They do have a tough road ahead, but they've weathered many a previous storm. Julie Rose, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block, out on an urban adventure on the water. A fast boat trip before dawn, in the rain, out onto New York City's Jamaica Bay. The A-train rumbles by on a bridge overhead. We've come out in pursuit of striped bass.
Let me tell you a little something about striped bass. They're pretty much a mirror of our society.
This is the captain, Vinny Calabro.
Striped bass are a hardy, vibrant fish that can endure a lot of crap.
And you figure if they can make it here, they can make it anywhere.
We are right next to Kennedy Airport right now. We could walk onto the runway, I think.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
If the striped bass wanted to meet their cousin, the European sea bass, they could hop on an Air France flight.
That's writer Paul Greenberg. We've come out fishing with him to talk about his new book titled Four Fish. It's a passionate indictment of overfishing and the collapse of wild populations. It's also a defense of farmed fishing, if done right. The striped bass we're pursuing today are a recent success story showing how wild populations can be protected. Striper numbers plunged through the 1970s, by some estimates down to fewer than 5 million due to overfishing and pollution. So some states closed their waters to striper fishing altogether. Others restricted fishing, Congress passed laws, and the striped bass did rebound, up to a high of 70 million. Paul Greenberg says with commercial fishing pressures reduced, these fish are in remarkably good shape, which means that now catching a striper by a busy international New York airport isn't a far-fetched idea.
I like being in a situation where this is like this living ecosystem that you can see the osprey around, you can see the menhaden in the water, big striped bass are around. It's like this kind of primeval prairie in the shadow, if you will, of Kennedy Airport.
So a primeval prairie with a control tower and 747.
Sure, but the striped bass can't see the control tower. And that there can even exist striped bass in this kind of environment makes you feel like we're not necessarily the boss of everything. We might have gotten the shore, but we haven't gotten the water yet.
Not yet. But still, watermen like Vinny Calabro will tell you about obvious declines in fish stocks.
And you've been fishing here since you were a kid, right?
So I've been on this bay since I'm 8 or 9. I'm 53, so, and it's every day. You're talking about thousands and thousands of hours a year.
So you actually could totally see when it was going down in the late 70s, early.
Well, yeah. See where you are right now?
Yeah.
Look north, look south, look west and east. Everywhere you can see, everywhere would be schools of bunker right now. Everywhere.
Bunker is menhaden, the bait fish they'll use to catch the bass. Their numbers are way down. But the menhaden are still all around the boat. You can spot them churning the water.
Easy on the spin.
Vinny Calabro throws out the circular cast net and soon hauls it in, filled with hundreds of glistening silver menhaden. So with a barrel full of bait, they start fishing for stripers. And yes, Paul Greenberg does recognize the ethical thorns here. The author of a book about overfishing, going out fishing.
The older I get, there's part of me that kind of enjoys not catching something. If you talked to me before I wrote this book, I definitely want to catch something, definitely want to put something in the pail, definitely want to bring something home to my family.
Not so much now?
Less so. I mean, I still go fishing. I still keep some fish that I catch. But I definitely viscerally feel it as a deduction that I'm making from nature. And there must be some karmic price to pay for it somewhere.
You think?
I think a little bit.
Well, you talk about that tension in the book. You talk about fish being seen as food, but also needing to be seen as wildlife.
Exactly. I mean, even the word seafood is a kind of a remarkably cruel word.
It's a strange word when you think about it.
It is. I mean, do we call everything that we eat from land, do we call it land food? You know what I mean? And what's interesting is that you go across cultures, it's consistent. Romance language speakers of Italian and German too, call it sea fruit. Slavs call them gifts of the sea. And it's as if it's this sort of arbitrary thing. I mean, people should understand that every time they eat a fish that wasn't raised on a farm, that they're eating a wild animal.
We now harvest about 90 million tons of wild fish and shellfish from the ocean every year.
Ooh, there's a fish!
Out on the bay, suddenly one of the rods has curved toward the water. It's a striper, about 14 pounds, 32 inches long.
There it is. Oh, yeah, it's a keeper.
Nice fish. Congratulations.
Soon after that, the rain becomes a downpour, and we head for shore. I pick up my conversation with Paul Greenberg later along the Hudson River. And his point is this, that wild fishing we just did, well, on a commercial, industrial scale, that's unsustainable. The world has doubled its per capita fish consumption in the last 50 years. The oceans can't keep up with our growing appetite. And that means, like it or not, the future lies with fish farming or aquaculture.
Aquaculture is the fastest growing form of food production in the world right now. And it's sure to equal and overtake wild catch in the next few years.
So the trick is how to do it right, how to farm fish with a small environmental footprint. Well, for one, it means choosing fish that are well adapted to aquaculture, fish that are efficient feeders, that don't need to eat huge amounts of fish meal to produce a pound of flesh. Think tilapia, or an Asian fish he likes called the barramundi. It also means keeping these farmed fish away from wild populations so they don't spread disease, which could mean that fish gracing your plate spent its life in the inner city.
What's interesting and kind of cool is they now have systems that you can plug right into the middle of a city, like in Baltimore, not far from your offices. They have this, in the center of Baltimore, they have a above-ground aquaculture operation where everything is recycled, where even methane gas is generated from the culture of fish and used to create energy to continue to power the system. These are modules that are being developed and that can be put in place.
Think back to those striped bass in Jamaica Bay. Paul Greenberg points out that today, 60% of the striped bass we eat are farm-raised hybrids. For sea bass, there are now nearly 10 times as many grown in aquaculture as are caught in the wild. 40 years ago, a farmed sea bass didn't even exist. But Greenberg says we have ignored the reality of what we're eating and what's gone. When it comes to fish, he says, we're engaged in a wave of psychological denial of staggering scope.
The denial is that we see these things in the marketplace. We see Irish salmon, we see Scottish salmon, we see Nova Scotia salmon. And the default assumption of the consumer is that those are just, no, those are wild fish from Ireland or Scotland. No, that is a practically extinct species. There's no more wild Atlantic salmon in the marketplace. That's a tragedy. It should be farmed Irish salmon. You know, we should know that. But I think a lot of consumers aren't realizing what's happening. What's this extinction followed by replacement with a domesticated variant is very much happening.
As for wild fish, Paul Greenberg says we must hunt them with care and eat them with the fullness of our appreciation and understand them, above all, as wildlife. You can read an excerpt from Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now we go from creatures in the water to creatures in the sky. Here's what we'd like you to do this morning. Look up at the sky and ask yourself, who's up there? Maybe you'll see a bird or a cloud or two. But according to researchers, that empty-looking space is teeming with wild animals. Well, they're very little wild animals, but still. NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich wanted to know more.
How did you even happen onto this question? Are you a guy who looks up a lot? Or
yes.
Matt Greenstone studies bugs. He's a research entomologist in Maryland, and years ago, he says,
on a balmy fall afternoon, I was biking home when suddenly little black specks started falling out of the sky.
Down they came, little black dots, looking kind of like strange black rain.
And there must have been, I'm sure there were, millions of them.
And as they landed, he thought, now, wait a second, these things, they're alive. Because if you look really closely at them,
you could see that they had legs.
Eight legs.
These were spiders.
Spiders.
So they had just fallen out of the sky.
And if this freaks you out, hold on, because we're going to ask a very interesting question here. Matt figured,
what comes down must have gone up. And how in the world did they get up there?
Who ever heard of flying spiders? Well, says entomologist May Barenbaum, 90 years ago, people already knew there were all kinds of bugs high off the ground.
Particularly when early planes would come back with, like, aphids plastered all over them.
Aphids? You
know. Oh, yeah.
And are aphids and spiders up in the air by mistake?
Nope.
May says these animals want to be carried off. And you can see the moths and gnats and wasps deliberately launching themselves into the air, especially the turbulent level of air, just up off the ground.
They'll climb up to a high point in their own environment, even if it's just a blade of grass.
They just stand straight up on their little back legs, and just by doing that, they can get part of their body up into this layer where it's more turbulent. And then if you can get a ride on a parcel that's going up, you can get off the ground, and then if you're lucky, you can get carried aloft.
Sometimes you can see them actually leaping, but, says Matt,
the way a spider does it is it has a silken thread, which can be quite a few number of meters long.
And what the spiders who landed on Matt and his bicycle did back those many years ago is he watched them crawl to the highest point they could.
Whether it was my finger or the bell on the bicycle, stick their little butts up in the air, which is where the silk comes from, and if the silk was caught by the breeze, they'd depart again.
Insects sometimes need to leave where they are and go someplace else, either for food or sex or for a variety of reasons. Bugs and spiders disperse. And when they do,
they're kind of gambling that wherever they end up is going to be better than where they're just leaving from.
So when you go out this month and you look up at a clear blue sky and you see nothing up there but air and blue and clouds, it turns out you are standing under a vast, teeming highway of animals invisible to you, but according to bug specialists Hugh Raffles and May Barenbaum and Matt Greenstone,
there's all manner of stuff floating around up there.
They found ladybugs at 6,000 feet.
Really tiny mites, which don't even have wings.
Parasitic flies, tiny little wasps.
Cucumber beetles at 3,000 feet.
Aphids.
Lots of aphids.
Scorpion flies at 5,000 feet.
Thrips.
Micro wasps.
Little fruit flies at 3,000 feet.
And scale insects.
Yep, there's a lot of insects.
Yeah, they're all up there.
When scientists first calculated the number of bugs in the sky on a typical, summer month,
the numbers were staggering.
To count bugs, what scientists do is that they imagine, let's say, a column of air 1 mile across going way up into the sky, and then they'll measure how many insects pass through that column in a month. The most recent answer, and this was done with a radar device in Great Britain by a team headed by Jason Chapman, and we found Jason.
We estimated about 30 million large insects would pass through in a month.
Did you just say 30 million?
30 million.
And these are the large guys?
These are the large ones. Our estimate for all of the insects, including all of the aphids and the tiny creatures, was 3 billion. So that's 3,000 million.
3 billion. That's like 10 times the population of the United States going over your head.
Yeah.
That's now, enormous.
It is enormous, yes.
And the entomologists were all absolutely amazed at what they fished out of the sky.
I was surprised, no doubt about that.
Because there's so much going on right over our heads that we didn't know anything about.
It's just that we have this notion that we own the planet, and that's kind of not the case.
But we do have our own animation, so you can watch a spider sailing high off the earth, dangling on a teeny silk thread. You can see the all-time altitude champion, a single male termite soaring 19,000 feet up, followed by a plummet to a sea of beetles and aphids and butterflies in glorious detail at npr.org/KRULWICH. And I am Robert Krulwich at NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When Barack Obama was running for president, he often got crowds to shout, "Fired up, ready to go." That fire has been missing from some of his presidential appearances, but it was in evidence yesterday. NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro was with the president as he visited Kansas City and Las Vegas.
About once a week, President Obama gives a speech on the economy. He visits a factory, often in a swing state, often involved in clean energy technology, and he talks about how the Economic Recovery Act kept that factory open. Yesterday, Air Force One touched down in Kansas City, a short walk from the airport hangar where Smith Electric builds batteries for electric trucks. A poster said, "Huge payloads, zero emissions." Companies like Coca-Cola and Frito-Lay use these electric trucks to make deliveries. President Obama said, "Some people argue we should abandon these efforts."
My answer is, come right here to Kansas City. Come see what's going on at Smith Electric. I think they're going to be hard-pressed to tell you that you're not better off than you would be if we hadn't made the investments in this plant.
That oblique partisan jab became an outright clobber later in the day. People sometimes accuse Mr. Obama of being too cool. But at a fundraiser for Senate candidate Robin Carnahan, he was anything but.
These folks drove the economy into a ditch, and they want the keys back. And you got to say the same thing to them that you say to your teenager. You can't have the keys back because you don't know how to drive yet.
Missouri's Republican Senator Kit Bond is retiring. That makes this a rare chance for Democrats to pick up a seat in a year when the party expects its majority to shrink. Mr. Obama took a far more partisan tone than he used in the presidential campaign 2 years ago. Flying to Missouri on Air Force One, White House spokesman Bill Burton gave this explanation for the shift.
You know, what the president said was he was going to come to Washington and do everything he could to move our country in the right direction. And when there are moments that help to illustrate the differences between our philosophy and their philosophy, the president has taken it upon himself to point those out to the American people.
Missouri never fell head over heels in love with Barack Obama. The state went for John McCain in 2008. And Mr. Obama is less popular now than he was then. So while he can generate enthusiasm and raise money for Carnahan, he also poses a risk. Carnahan's Republican opponent Roy Blunt said in a conference call with reporters, "I believe he's helping me more than her." Mr. Obama seemed to acknowledge that risk when he made the case for why voters should send Carnahan to Washington.
She's not even going there to represent every aspect of either party's agenda or my agenda.
But elsewhere in the speech, he seemed to take a different view of the role Carnahan would play if she were elected. He said if she were in the Senate, a Wall Street regulation bill would already be law.
I need another vote. It'd be helpful.
As he stood on the stage, he put his arm around Carnahan. It's an image Blunt will likely use in his campaign ads in the fall to tie his opponent to the policies coming out of Washington. Here in Las Vegas, the situation is different. Mr. Obama came here to help a man who helped set the Washington agenda, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. David Damore teaches political science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He says Senator Reid and President Obama are both trying to win a popularity contest that they have been losing for months.
It's an uphill battle because I think clearly they lost the message war the first time around on both the stimulus and the health care, and now it's a little harder to sort of change the perception among voters.
Reid is already running ads touting the impact of the health care bill on people in Nevada. This morning, he joins President Obama to discuss the impact of the Economic Recovery Act. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, traveling with the president in Las Vegas.